While longboarding is definitely not a crime, it's a great way to express yourself.
You're not gonna die, it's just sand.
The longboard was considered something of a dinosaur.
The side slip boogie. It takes experience.
I'd ride a shortboard if I wanted to, I would, but I just don't find it interesting. Why be like everyone else when you can be different? One fin, one God, one country.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to the LINAC podcast. My name is TJ Ridings, and my special guest today is Devin Howard. You all know him. You all love him. How you doing today, Devin?
Hey, TJ. I don't know if about the all love him part. It depends where people surf. They may not love it.
I might give you a proper intro after this, but I think most people are aware of who you are, especially for the audience.
Yeah, I've been involved with longboarding for a little while. Was behind the scenes a little bit here and there doing magazine work, and then sort of realized, man, surfing's pretty fun. I'll pop out on the other side too.
Definitely. I guess the first question I would have for you is, how did longboarding enter into your life? Surfing in general, I suppose too, but when did longboarding really grab a hold?
When I was quite young, I've told this story a few places, so sorry if this is boring to anyone that's heard it before, but a kid down the street, there was some surf, a bunch of brothers in the neighborhood I was in. There was four sets of brothers, all surfed, all 2 years apart, and one of those brothers was the Tudor family, and Joel Tudor's older brother was my age, Josh, and we were all riding shortboards. And then I remember Joel getting into longboard surfing. It was a little strange, seemed kind of odd. I wasn't immediately into it, I guess. Stayed on the shortboard, and I think I was around 14 or something. I injured my back pretty bad. I was out of the water for quite a while. I jumped off a roof, got a compression fracture in my back. And I was in a back brace, the whole thing. And I remember the first time going back to the water, I'd gone to the beach with the Tudor family. And Joel had already, at that point, had just gotten sponsored by Donald Takayama. And he had an extra board, and I just tried it. And it's as simple as that. Wow, there's actually something to this. And then when you started looking around and noticing there were no other young kids, so to speak, doing it, there was sort of a cool factor to that. I think at that age, I was already, getting really into music and trying to listen to obscure music. Early on, I knew I wasn't in love with the idea of mainstream, really anything, which is why I wasn't attracted to school sports. Surfing was it. And then longboarding was this other level of cool, this other subculture that really drew me in.
Do you remember what the board was, like what shape it was that Joel lent you?
It had this like crazy sponge, like airbrush job on it, this really like complex psychedelic. I would say it was obviously a Takayama, as I'd said, but I would say it was kind of like what Donald would call a speed shape. It was a round, kind of pulled in round tail and pulled in nose, but I had no idea what it was. It was just a longboard to me. I think it was like 9'2". And I ended up loving the board. And then I convinced Joel to sell it to me. And I remember actually getting in big trouble for buying the board because Joel sold it to me for $250. And it was in really good shape. And I didn't know. And Joel's dad got super pissed. He thought I had conned Joel into selling it for cheap. And his dad, like, you know, basically wanted me to give the board back. It was this whole big thing. But anyways, it worked out. I was able to keep the board and rode that board for a year or two until I broke it. And the very first time I paddled out at Winansea, it was a sad day.
That's super sad. I bet you wish you still had that one, huh?
Oh man, I really do, because that was the board that started everything. Yeah, I've got this really pathetic picture of me standing in front of my friend's 72 Land Cruiser. He was old enough to drive, and I'm holding the two pieces. And that was my first lesson in what would break a longboard, is that dang leash. I was wearing a leash because it was pretty big. Wind and sea, and I was just completely clueless, didn't understand the reef. This big old wave just broke right in my head and pop.
Yeah, and wind and sea is kind of a an interesting, kind of tricky wave.
Yeah, it's got a lot of power for how mushy looking it is in appearance. It's got a quite a bit of energy. There's some deep water way out there. And but what, you know, like all waves, once you figure it out, it's pretty easy to dial in. And I ended up spending maybe the next 10 years highly dedicated to that spot. I was just like, I lived and died by that spot. I was so drawn to wind and sea. They hated longboarders, man, just hated. It was not cool at all. I mean, you want to talk about being called names? I was called faggot, like every explicative you could imagine. And it didn't really, it's weird. It didn't really bother me. It actually made me like it more. It was more like, well, fuck you guys. I'm just going to learn how to surf better than you. And I'm going to do it without a leash, by the way. It was like this whole thing. And I wasn't very good. I pretty much sucked until I was in my mid 20s probably. And even then, I look back on video now, I'm like, man, I just wasn't that good. I got better later in life, which is pretty cool thing about surfing in general. It comes to you in different points of your life where you can dedicate more time and be more open to learning things and understanding your equipment, and you can get better at it at really unexpected periods of your life.
Yeah, and I think that's one of the cool things about longboarding in general, is that it gives you more of an opportunity to continue surfing well and to continue to get better as you age.
Absolutely. It's like, it's kind of like dancing in that regard. If you know, you've ever been at I'm sure you've been to a wedding, who hasn't been to a wedding, and you see some of your oldest uncles and some of the grandparents, and they can just barely walk into the building. But it's so odd that when the music comes on, they are all of a sudden gliding across the floor. Like, how does that happen? And there's just something with dance that it kind of keeps that old age thing at bay. I can't, I'm sure a kinesiologist could explain what the reasons are for that. But yeah, you know, evidence of that when we were younger was just watching how Skip Fry and Donald Takayama and that whole generation, how they were still shredding in their 50s and 60s. That was the blueprint, you know, and that's sort of the path some of us are on anyways. Those of us that stuck with it, I'm about to turn 50 next week, which is trippy. But still feeling it, still inspired, still looking to equipment that makes makes it easier. So I think that there's a common theme to surfing better, is getting to know your equipment. Who it doesn't matter who's shaping it, but just get to know it, find out what works, and get rid of the stuff that doesn't work.
Yeah, I think that definitely comes with getting older and understanding yourself better. You know, you've gotten to know yourself pretty well, and you know what works for you and you know what doesn't. I think we're exactly 10 years apart, not exactly, but about 10 years apart, and I definitely aspire to be surfing as good as you are when I'm about to turn 50.
Oh, thank you. Well, you can as long as you don't stop. I think one of the things that maybe was helpful is I've had kids late in life. When kids come along, for those of us that have kids, it's a massive detour of surf time for good reason, right? It's like you want to be there, and the whole point of having children is to be a parent. And so we have a 3-year-old, one and a half, and like a 3-month-old. So the amount of time in the water in the last, especially with the third child, it's less, but it's by choice. I want to be around. It's like you want to be there in morning, all morning, as long as you can before you head to work. And then when you toward the end of the day, it's like instead of letting that meeting run late or chit chatting, outside the office, you're like, I'm bolting home. And it'll be interesting to see where the surfing goes over the next few years. But I think as the kids get their footing and more excited about the beach, hopefully they'll dig surfing, and maybe we could be doing a lot of that as a family.
Yeah, that'd be cool. I've got two kids as well, and yeah, we ran into each other at RinCon a couple weeks ago and
Yeah.
got to meet the family. That was pretty cool.
Yeah.
But I found when we first had kids, before that, I was still surfing, but I was taking it for granted almost, you know? And then when I had kids, I was like, okay, I only have so much free time. I'm going to use it no matter what. And it turned me from the type of surfer who would look at the waves in the morning, and if it wasn't exactly what I wanted to do, I just wouldn't go, to I'm going no matter what. And so
Sure.
it definitely became more of a priority, and I realized how important it was. And like you were saying, if you want to be a good parent, you basically just have to be around and you have to be there for the kids. So you want to spend a lot of your time doing that.
Absolutely, man. It's
But
so important. But I think the key to longevity is your attitude, surrounding yourself with people that want to go, to the beach. And that, so like whoever your partner is should hopefully like the beach. Maybe even better, they surf. And then just go, take it easy on indulging too much in things that don't support a healthy body. And everybody knows what that is. And no one needs to hear a lecture from anybody on, everybody knows, but just like, don't go too hard on any of the stuff that is going to tweak your body out to where you're not able to be in reasonable shape. No one has to be like triathlete shape to go surfing, but keep the big, the big belly at bay, and you can still surf at a level that makes you feel good. Because there's nothing worse than like being at a pretty good level of surfing and then knowing, man, I've really let myself go, and then you sort of get self-conscious about it, and then I've seen it happen to a lot of people in my life. They just sort of recede into the background, just kind of stop surfing. And yeah, you look around you, like I said, the Skip Fries and those types, whoever those people are in your community, they don't need to be a known legend, but look at them. A lot of them have been surfing 50 plus years. That's very inspiring. And my game plan is to surf until the 90s. That's my goal.
just surf right into the grave.
Yeah, pretty much.
You mentioned earlier when you were talking about getting into longboarding and getting hassled and stuff like that. For me, I was coming up and really started to go all the time, like in the later 90s. And so I was kind of at the tail end of the like longboard negativity, and then it kind of all changed into the 2000s. And there was a lot, it was a lot more open. But if you could elaborate a little bit more on what that was like being a longboarder in your area, some of the challenges.
Well, some of the goods, it's good and bad, you know, that it wasn't all bad, but the good, I like the good parts of it were, there was a just this massive community up and down the coast because it wasn't a mainstream thing for young folks. Doing club contests was something to really look forward to. Again, that was something that I was introduced to by the Tudor family. They were involved with the Oceanside Longboard Club, even though we lived 20 minutes south of there. So I just kind of jumped in with them through that. And man, that was like opened a door to a whole world I didn't know existed. It was all these other people that loved this thing like you did up and down the coast. Because, you know, there was no, obviously no social networks and ways to stay in touch outside of the phone. And you weren't discovering things on a screen. You were discovering them for real in real life. Which is funny to say. It's like, I'm like, wow, that isn't a thing anymore, you know, where you can at your fingertips know just about anything you want to right now without even going there ever. So I think there was a lot of positive things. There was some funny negative stuff, which was just a general pushback. And I think some of it was understandable. You know, it was a battle for a resource. It was more than just like a criticizing your personal choice or aesthetic. It was, hey, it's, you know, these boards are a serious menace when, you know, with that, what is that? With great power comes great responsibility. And it's very easy to forget what a wave harvester a longboard is, right? I mean, it's kind of stating the obvious, but surprisingly, some people didn't quite get that. So that was a source of a lot of conflict. So I was cognizant of that. I was hyper aware that some of the places I wanted to surf were not known for longboard surfing. At Wind and Sea specifically, Joel had already started surfing there, and I knew it, and I kind of watched from a distance. And you know, he'd share with me the stories. There was this other guy, Mike Myers, who you post a lot of stuff from Longboard Magazine. I mean, his nickname was the Animal, and he was something else, man. I mean, I didn't know the guy, but I was just so in awe of this wild, hairy, tanned, ripped man that would just destroy the waves in a good, you know, in like a good ripping, tearing way, going, you know, straight off the bottom on a well overhead wave, you know, things you and I would consider 8 to 10 foot faces, squaring off the bottom, just going straight at the face, getting 90% of the board over the top of the lip, then riding on the roof of the wave and then floating down and landing in the flats and coming out and then going into a cutback. Now, it wasn't, I'm not saying it was like the most stylish, smoothest thing, but it was the most radical thing I'd seen. I was like, man, this is cool, you know, like, heck yeah, he's showing these shortboard guys what's up, you know, like that was really encouraging, you know, in that sort of late 80s period. And there were other characters sort of throughout Southern California. You know, if you went up to San Onofre, Jeff Kramer, Jed Morehouse, obviously the Paskowitz. A lot of those guys have been doing this for years before I even had a clue what that longboards existed. So there was all this like really fun, exciting energy, and I think there was a really cool sense of camaraderie because there wasn't, we were just outsiders, really. And that was always like, if you think of why did everyone get started, you know, everyone started surfing in all the decades prior, because it was, you felt like it was a middle finger to the man. And it was like, I'm not going to plug into the machine. I'm not going to do what's expected and be told. I'm going to rebel. And surfing, as well as obviously skateboarding and other activities like it, are like the ultimate expression of that personal freedom, anti-establishment attitude. And I think some people scratch their head when I describe longboard surfing as that to me because it in the 80s it was just so, it was as lame as rollerblading. Like it was as lame as like a pogo stick or a snake board. Like, are you kidding me? Longboarding, and especially as a kid, lame. So there was no support really outside of the communities you were involved in and the club contests. That was a place where you're like, okay, I feel like I belong to something really special. Once you got outside of that, there was a sense like, we don't like you. You never saw pictures in any magazines or videos or things like, there was nothing that you could connect with, the kind of stuff you wanted to see. But that all began to change. And that was really exciting. The late 80s, things are ramping up more. And it's not like people weren't longboarding. I'm just speaking mostly to young people because you're looking around at your peers, right? It was an old man's thing, and it was in full force. Like late 90s, longboarding's pretty well established in the lineup, and there's all these the battles we just talked about. But when things started getting kind of cooler and shifting, was magazine began springing up. Some longboard videos started springing up, like this guy Chris Bystrom shows up from nowhere from Australia, and he's filming Tudor and all these people. And we're, I was just kind of an observer. I think I had like one random wave in there, and it's pretty bad. But I was like, whoa, something really cool is happening. Herbie Fletcher starts doing these movies with Joel and all of the peers, and man, I was so inspired by that. I was like, that's what I want to do. So I set a goal to get good enough to compete and work in those kinds of projects. And that set the course for my life, not in a professional sense, but more as like, what are my passions going to be outside of whatever I do for a job?
You mentioned Herbie Fletcher, and I think in his videos was the first time that I was aware of you and like your video parts. And his movies are classic. They're all time. Most of the longboarders, from your time, from my time and after. Pretty much devoured all those movies because he had all the good guys in them. And I would say that I went through a period where I didn't really get, like, I got that I liked all these guys, but I was like, what is up with these? They use the same music, like the surf rock music. There's too many Herbie sections and things like that. And I was like, I don't think I like Herbie Fletcher. And then all of a sudden, when I got a little older and I was watching those movies again, I was like, oh my gosh, all the things like Herbie was saying, like he would talk himself up and all that. I was like, he was actually 100% correct. He kind of is better than everybody in these movies. And when, especially when I got into the history of him and watching his stuff from the 60s and how good he was when he was so young and everything. It's pretty wild and it's pretty special that we had those movies.
And look, your critique of him is, I've heard that from a lot of people. If I may share just a little quick thing about Herbie, and the guy had a huge impact on my life, and he probably doesn't even know this really. Like, I'm not super close with him, but again, it ends up sounding like it's always tough in these things because I have to always reference Joel Tudor, and it sounds like I'm a sycophant or something, but
You're
I do believe it's important in life when you look back to not forget where the doors were opened. And the guy did open a lot of doors. And again, he brought me along to some of these shoots. I'm in them surfing with Joel because of Joel. He brought me along, and he believed in my ability enough to say like, hey, Herbie, let's, point the camera this guy's way. And then I really connected with Herbie. I mean, I was tripping out on, you know, he had this big ego and he was wild, and he, the way he spoke, I mean, he used more cuss words than anyone I'd ever heard in my life. And I was like, is this guy full of it? You know, but I knew he could surf. And what I liked about him was his enthusiasm and his just his energy. You know, like a lot of surfers when they go to make surf films, I'm sure people listening to this may not be that interesting, but anybody listening that has ever worked on a surf film or wanted to, a lot of the surfers are pretty flaky and just not that serious about it, which is a good thing in some ways, you know. But if you're trying to actually get something done and work on a project, imagine any project where whatever the endeavor is, over half the people are not showing up or just not really putting in the effort. In her, I liked Herbie because he didn't put up with any of that bullshit. Like, you had to show up at a certain time, and if you weren't there, he would leave you. You know, and he drove kind of a hard bargain, but the result was these prolific, he was very prolific. He's putting out a couple of two, at least two of those videos a year for a while. That's crazy, you know. And the critique of his videos were, oh, well, they're not artistic, they're not pieces of art. And it's like, well, I think he was just on point with where all of that was at the time. You know, nobody had a big budget for it, so they weren't going to shoot 16 millimeter film, which would have he would have had to spend 30 to 50 grand per project. But video was just so quick and inexpensive and accessible, and it just made all of this stuff so attainable. And Herbie, to his credit, he documented a period of longboard surfing that hardly anybody has. You know, I think Matt and Brittany made some of their films, and they deserve credit because they were in Herbie's movies, but they also made some of their own. You know, obviously Jay Brother made his film, that sort of 95, 96 with a drift. Thomas Campbell kind of came in on the heels of all these people. But Herbie really gets credit in my mind of documenting, you know, pretty much the 90s, right, into the early 2000s, when very few, just like hardly anybody was documenting this. And he was just capturing people that were in within his sphere. So a lot of people didn't get in his movies, unfortunately, but a lot of Southern Californians, a lot of Hawaiians. And yeah, tip of the hat to Herbie. The guy's a legend. And he one last thing, he took me on my first, I would say my first real like surf trip. And we went down to Baja, and I think the movie was Baja Pacific. I don't remember. It was one of those movies.
Yep, I think that's it.
Yeah, and that was quite an adventure. I think I, whichever movie that was, I think I had a chin strap beard and a shaved head or something. It was a very strange look.
Yeah, you had the full sleeve rash guards going on back then, the hotline.
Yeah. Hey man, there were free hotline wetsuits. That was a big deal.
Totally. And I think that's one of the things about longboarding and longboard sponsors and things like that is there wasn't a lot going around. So you kind of had to take what you could get.
This is true. Yeah, I think the only people that were, you know, really, I guess, making a living at the time, Tudor. And then when Bonga sort of made a big splash on the scene, I think he was doing decent, and Colin McPhillips.
Yeah.
And, you know, gosh, outside of that, I'm sure I'm forgetting some other people, but it was a four or five person group of people that were making enough to support themselves. You know, they weren't killing it,
Yeah,
but
exactly.
that's okay. And that's what's part of the charm, and that's what's sort of endearing about the whole thing. You know, and it was always interesting to see and watch like competition and longboard surfing. And it was always sort of at odds with itself, I thought. I always struggled with it. I participated in it because it felt like that was the best way to really stay involved, and it was a nice personal challenge. But I feel like as time went on, the real beauty and the real attraction and the real gift of longboard surfing was away from competition. It just seems to be a better fit.
Yeah. And, you know, back to Herbie, like, I want to make it clear that, like, you talked about how, you know, a critique that his stuff wasn't artistic. And, like, obviously the more artistic films came later with Thomas Campbell stuff. And, I mean, even Jay Brothers stuff with Adrift was very artistic and all that stuff. And I was very drawn to that stuff. But as that really picked up and, like, everybody was doing the more artistic movies and having, like, I was just watching Shelter recently, and it was like, obviously that movie's great, great surfing, but like all the voiceover is so like funny and like kind of like serious. Yeah. And it really reminds me why Herbie's movies were so great and why in reality, like, that's really kind of what I want to see as far as a longboarder goes. It's more of the surf porn kind of thing.
Yes.
And the fact that it was like unartistic gives it its own artistic vibe in a way that like sets itself apart.
Yeah.
And to me, like watching those now, like those are awesome. Like that's kind of really what I want to see.
Yeah. And the word artistic it's clearly subjective. I mean, Herbie is an artist. We know, like, those who know of him.
He
paints some really cool boards. He does sculptures. And I hope what I said doesn't sound like some kind of critique. I'm just sharing that for whatever reason, people would critique it and be like, oh, you know, they're just sort of like these surf videos. There's not a lot of depth to them. But I agree with you, like, in over the test of time, now that we can look back years later, he provided the most entertainment and the most value, probably. You know, you got a lot of surfing and quite a bit of variety. You got a lot of him surfing too, which is, it's kind of, in a way, it's kind of funny because it's like the filmmaker guy's like, I'm just going to show you guys what's up. And he would like legitimately do that. Like that Baja trip I was talking about, people were sort of lollygagging and he would get so like frustrated and like, come on, I'm not going to use the words he used, but let's just say he had some pretty strong motivational speeches in the morning to get people in the van. And he's just like, stop fucking around, you know, like I'll surf circles around you guys. And he could totally back it up, man.
He could totally back it up.
So rad, you know, and there's nobody like that guy. And he really is a gem. And I don't know if history has been, I don't know, kind enough to him. It's almost like a lot of that stuff sort of forgotten because it's just all sitting on VHS tapes. Like if it wasn't, I guess you're probably the only one who's grabbing clips and at least putting them on Instagram. It would be so sick if we could figure out if someone could get through to Herbie and get those things distributed, and somebody should sponsor it and buy them off him and just put them on YouTube. Cause it's a cultural goldmine, I think, you know, in a period of time that's worth celebrating and revisiting. And gosh, there's just some incredible surfing in there. Like some of the stuff you put up of like Cody or God, there's a lot of really good Tyler Hatzikian stuff that he's just firing on all cylinders. And you know, we could go on for a while. So hats off to Herbie, man. And hats off to you for sharing the stuff.
Yeah, man. Thank you. Yeah, you know, I noticed the same thing that like those were so influential to me and to a lot of people I know. And there was literally no place to find them. And so just literally on a whim, I have most of the videos, most of the magazines, and my buddy supplied a lot of the other ones. And I was just like, I'll just start throwing these up, see if anybody's interested. Like I thought they would be, and it just kind of worked out that way. And it's been super fun for me to revisit everything.
Yeah. I mean, you're probably not going to run out of things to share for quite a while. I mean, how many longboard videos did he make? Like 2 dozen?
Yeah, there's so many. There's some I haven't even seen that I'm trying to track down. But and you know, they're just special. There's something that's they're like disjointed and weird segments that don't really fit with anything else. And in it itself, that's like the beauty of it. And like I think of those movies and the way they are and how like they run the gamut of like really good surfing, really silly stuff. Silly music, whatever the deal is. That's kind of what longboarding is. Like, it's
Yeah.
like there is a super cool, like actually cool vibe to longboarding. And then there's the goofy side to it and like an unserious side to it that will always be there too.
Yeah, man, what a cool time. Jed, if you know who Jed Morros is,
Yeah, I do.
his brother Mason edited a lot of those films.
Yeah, he was involved with a lot of them. I know that. And Jed, in general, he's one of those guys that like I'm assuming it was the same for you. Seeing him do the kind of stuff he did with the like helicopters and fin first takeoffs and all that stuff was I was just like I'd seen things kind of like that, but never like he did them.
Yeah, and that was like a very San Clemente thing. San Clemente was always,
Still is.
oh yeah, and no, it's true. It's just like the center of progressive surfing, and in the longboard world, it was like, yeah, that whole Paskowitz camp, and then Jed is sort of watching that, and Kramer, and those, a couple other people like that, watching that, and again, like, everybody, the bar was being set at we as longboard surfers can surf as good as you can on your shortboard, and it was interesting to see where that went some years later, for better or for worse, depending on what your point of view is. If you're from Hawaii or Brazil, you would argue for worse. I've had plenty of people get in my face about me helping ruin longboard surfing. Like, had a guy like shove me off my board and try to fight me in the water, a Brazilian guy, just a few years ago. So it's been an interesting ride, like how this thing's
Somebody
been
you
playing.
knew?
No, didn't know the guy. It was a yeah, I was at Malibu, and he was in front of me, and then whatever, I got around him, no big deal. I didn't touch him. I'm like, okay, well, you're not going fast enough, so I'm going to get in front of you now. And then somehow he got into a position where he got as close as he could, and then he like tackled me off the board. And we came up, and I was like, what did you do that for? We could have ridden the wave together the whole way, like whatever. And
Yeah,
he's
it's
like, fuck
Malibu.
you. Fuck you, Devin Howe. Fuck you. You fucking ruined the sport. And I'm like, what are you talking about? Longboard surfing, progressive, you're taking it back to the Stone Age. And I'm like, what are you talking about? The direction that longboard surfing has taken in sort of the mainstream sense in the last decade, a more traditional approach has settled in. And depending where you're coming from, that's a really great thing, or it's the worst. And, that's always been the sort of saddest part about longboard surfing is it's almost like a partisan politics, right? Where like
Yeah.
you're left or you're right, and there's nothing in between. There's no like we can't even live in the same town now. Like that's I don't think it's as bad as it used to be, but
Yeah.
it's funny. I sat on a plane recently. I don't want to say the guy's name, but a guy who I respect, and he's was a well-known high performance guy. I hadn't seen him in 20 years. We had a great chat, and I was like, "Hey, what do you think about how things have gone the last?" And he's like, "It sucks. It's lame. We should be hitting the lip and pulling into giant barrels. It's so weak, so slow." So it's really fascinating where it's at and what the take is, but I think the majority of people globally are really digging traditional longboard surfing and that aspect of it. Doesn't matter what I think, it's just that's kind of what's going on.
Yeah, and they can believe whatever they want, but it's not your fault. And guess what? They can still surf exactly the way they want to. No
That's
one, no one's
what I
stopping
saw.
it. And
Yeah.
like when I was a kid, and most of the contests and stuff were dominated by there was just more high performance longboarders in the contests and stuff. And I always, considered myself and gravitated more towards the traditional. I was always have been a, big Joel fan and a big fan of yours and et cetera, Tyler. But back then, we all had 2+1s too. Like I had my nose riders and I had my more traditional boards, but I always had a 2+1. And
Sure.
I rode it when it was necessary, and I don't know how it got so far one way or the other. But like when I was a kid, I just all the things I wanted and weren't readily available, like more traditional stuff, cooler clothes with lower profile logos, like all black wetsuits, like that wasn't around. And then now that's like all that's around. And I'm kind of like, now I want to like kind of revisit some of the stuff I used to do, like, or and ride 2+1s again and stuff like that. So, I don't think it really matters. Whatever you're having fun doing, that's a cliche thing to say, but you can surf however you want. Nobody's stopping you.
Yeah, I hope that's where we land, and so when it comes to the traditional thing in that guy that tackled me, he was really, he was specifically zeroing in on competition surfing, which globally speaking, I guess the majority of the people that longboard don't really follow it or are not that interested in it. It's sort of a small amount of people that are highly passionate about it. It's usually the people competing and their families, and the audience just isn't as big as we sometimes hope it would be. And a few years back, I got a phone call from Wingnut to work at the WSL. And he's like, "Hey, we need some help with the longboard tour. We've got this traditional longboard criteria that we've had for 2 years now, and we're having trouble implementing it. The surfers are not taking to it. And we don't have anyone who can really connect the dots with the judges, the competitors, the whole organization, et cetera, et cetera. I think you'd be the perfect guy to do it." I'm like, "Oh man, that sounds like the worst job on the planet." I was like, "So you want me to go in and tell a whole group of people who mostly ride high performance longboards to stop doing that and for them to be excited about it?" So I said no several times until it was one of those they made me an offer I couldn't refuse type thing.
Yeah.
My wife was like, just it wasn't very for very much money, and it was like I already had a full-time job, I didn't need it. She was like, just throw out a number, throw out like some ridiculous number, and I did. And then they're like, okay, and I was like, shit, I should ask for more. And so it was this. It really was like a part-time thing that I did. It was like a above and beyond what the job I already had at the time. And yeah, I went into it and I looked at the criteria and was like, okay, if this what the league wants to do, and then wrote out a whole basically a whole training approach to train the judges. It took about a year of some hiccups. I'd say by the second year of being there, we started getting a rhythm, and by the third year, and then it kind of got to a place where I was like, all right, this is pretty good, and kind of dipped out of there. And it's sort of interesting to see like WSL kind of comes and goes with its enthusiasm, but my understanding is they do have four events right now, so they're still doing it. The surfing, if you like traditional longboard surfing, I think it's improved and it's more aligned with what its goals are. And so, yeah, it's always interesting to have these conversations with people because some people are like, yeah, fully on board with this traditional thing. It's the best thing ever. Some people not so much, but yeah, my takeaway is that still globally more people are digging the traditional thing and we'll see where they take it, but it looks like it's off and kind of in a good space.
Yeah, I think like at the more traditional waves, like it just makes sense and it goes along with the idea that you should ride the appropriate equipment in the appropriate waves. And then sometimes when I'm watching and, you know, the waves get bigger or funkier or something, it seems a little like they need to switch their equipment up a little bit. I'm not saying we need to go full high pro or anything, but I think a lot of people's minds were blown like this past season. Was it El Salvador? When Kyle Flint and Connie had that one, it was really the whole event, but it was really cool to see him do more rail surfing on his longboard, because that was one thing that I kind of missed, you know.
Connie or Kai?
Kai primarily. Like I was like I a lot of rumblings about how good he was surfing.
Yeah, I think I've said this somewhere else, but the way that Kai surfs is the way that we envisioned this whole criteria being applied. You know, like when I was trying to explain what the criteria, kind of like what it means and what it should look like, that the kind of surfing he was doing last year is exactly it. And it's not a nose riding contest. It's this balanced approach of using the full length of the board, that kind of tip to tail surfing, which is what I'd always been into. And even when I was competing in the 90s and 2000s, and it was like all high performance, I was riding 2+1s, but trying to do, you know, didn't surf as well as Kai, but trying to do stuff like that, where you're keeping the board moving, keeping it interesting, and not cruising, not like a lot of downtime, but also not spazzing out and making it feel rushed. You know, the tempo is important. I think that's what Kai has done really well. And the other Kai Salas as well, who won the title. I think that guy has a phenomenal ability to adapt. You know, he's like one of the better high performance surfers of all time. And then when things went traditional, I was impressed by his ability to like focus, hone in, pay attention, and adapt his surfing really well. Probably one of the best guys. And Taylor Jensen did the same thing. You know, like once Taylor realized, okay, this traditional thing's pretty dug in, you know, look at what he did. He reworked his equipment with Stu Kenson, I actually thought Taylor Jensen got kind of screwed on some of his heats last year.
Yeah, so did
I. It was really interesting because it's like the most radical, the most accomplished high performance surfer in the last decade. He's doing what the league is asking, and then he's not getting the scores. I couldn't believe it.
I know, and he was really doing it to a T. Like,
yeah,
if you didn't like Taylor before, he proved how good he is at longboarding by completely switching things up. And obviously he could always do that. He just preferred to ride the other boards more often.
Yeah.
And with Kai, it was the same thing. Like for me, because I think Taylor and I are exactly the same age. We grew up doing contests together and, you know, I was around Kai too. Like say what you want about high performance longboarding, but like Kai especially, like he was always very stylish when he was doing those high performance maneuvers.
So gnarly, the gnarliest cutbacks.
Yeah, like and just so smooth the way he would like roundhouses back into the lip in Hawaii and like airdropping and making it look clean, you know.
Yeah,
And
they look
not many
good.
people could do that. And so I was really rooting for those two guys. And then like I said, Kyle Ellis Flint really blew my mind. And I mean, all those guys are really good.
Yeah,
But it's just they, and it's the judge sport thing. Like it's always gonna be, you're never gonna please everybody.
yeah.
And I just, I liked to see, and like I know what some of these guys are capable of. And I mean, I'm not in love with super high performance longboarding, although I respect it. But sometimes, I want to see more rail surfing.
Yeah. Well, I think that's the key to all this is respecting it. And that's when I went into that WSL job, that was my position, was it's no secret that I like traditional longboard surfing. But I also totally understood and respected the other side. And that's why in the criteria, we did not specify what kind of board you rode. And there was a real push from some folks. Like, we've got to make it a single fin only. I was like, I think that's a mistake. I think you should set the criteria and you should allow the surfers to dictate where this thing goes. And, why should we inhibit people? Like, if someone can figure out a way to make a four fin work, why? I just feel like that's wrong to dictate. Just put out the criteria and let the surfers figure it out. And then the design trend always, the surfers sort of follow each other anyways, like that's what happens with shortboarding. If you watch the WSL CT stuff, why do all the boards look the same? Because there's this over years, they're just continuously, fine-tuning the equipment to get the scores that they think the judges are after. And I think it's good that the longboard folks left the fin thing alone, but I think they did institute something after I left that, like, the weight of the surfboard. I was like, oh my gosh, that is so pedantic and silly and paternalistic. Like, come on, just l leave it up to the surfers to like let them ride what they want to ride. And if you're doing the job of training the judges on the front end, they should be able to get it right. And I think that's where some of the things fell through the cracks with Taylor not getting scores and even Kaya Ellis getting super underscored on things that were dead on.
It was almost like he was like, if you like, it seemed like since he was doing so much rail work, they were like, better get back to the nose. Like, it's like, it was like that was too high performance or something.
Yeah, but it was like not at all. It was like the ultimate example of where traditional longboarding should be heading,
I know.
and it's this continuous uninterrupted flow, this dance in the pocket, not out on the shoulder. A lot of the turns and nose rides are from some of the surfers are out on the shoulder. Those shouldn't be not scored as high as they have been. Everybody needs to be steep and deep and in the pocket and pushing things. That's where all the best surfing happens. Always has, always will.
Yeah, no matter what you're on.
Totally. Absolutely. So.
Yeah, I liked what you said, and like about the talk of making it single fin only. While it does seem like there's like an unspoken like rule that, because no one, I didn't see anyone ride a three fin, I don't think, like the whole season last year. And everyone's kind of riding their single fins no matter what. And I remember it was, I think for Bells, I noticed that a lot of people, and there was a lot of talk of people basically getting like 2+1 speed shapes made. And I
Right.
was actually getting kind of excited for that. I was like, oh, we're bringing back a little bit of the old school. Like, and nobody ended up surfing on them during the contest.
Yeah, I remember that. Yeah.
And I know they all had them, but nobody took them out. And
Do you remember what the tease was for that? It was like a month or two before the event. Harrison Roach put out a clip on pretty sizable bells on a 2+1 with no leash.
Yeah, that was pretty sick.
I was like, yes, like that. That's where this thing makes sense. And I would have loved to have seen it more people go that route. But if I remember correctly, the waves just, once the event was underway, the waves just weren't really big enough to justify doing that.
Yeah, I think there were moments, but back to what you were saying before, like having them weigh the boards and making it only single fin if they did that. It seems silly because, like you said, to me, it's always been more of a judging problem than an equipment problem. And the creams should rise to the top and no matter what you're riding. So if you look like shit on a single fin or you look like shit on a thruster longboard, then you look like shit. That's how it should go. Like you shouldn't get the scores.
Totally. Yeah, I'm totally with you. I really like the 2+1 boards, and I've been dreaming about them a lot. I've jumped on a few here and there. And there is a time and a place for them, But I got so into the eggs, which everyone calls mid-lengths now. So into those that the 2+1 just sort of, there really wasn't like a need for it, And I developed this lane of, if it's head high and under, I'm riding a log. And then if it's over that, I'm going to jump on an egg. And then, in the last few years, I worked on a project with, Wayne Rich, which was this with Channel Islands, the CI log that came out. And we had a lot of fun with that because we wanted to give the log another gear without actually putting edge on it. Because, like CJ Nelson and a few others have been pushing, not pushing boundaries, but they've just been like breaking the rules, right? Like you should never have edge. And I've tried some of the edge boards. Edge logs, I just didn't like them. And what I didn't like about them is, when you're on a log and you do like a left go right or right go left, and you sort of project and whip the board off the bottom and start walking up the face to hit a nose ride. Do you know what I'm talking about? Like either a bottom turn or a one turn,
Totally. When you're
you're
doing
pushing the
that
board.
little pivot setup for the nose ride.
Yeah, and you're at high speed. Maybe more accurately is like a big fading bottom turn, and you whip the board off the bottom, off the trough of the wave. It slingshots you up the wave face. And this is particularly at like a Malibu, a Rincon, or Church, a Middles, anywhere that's got a running wall. Sorry, I just named a bunch of rights. This I love going right. My friends know that, make fun of me for it all the time. The edge boards would sort of lock in and they would pick a line. Like once they picked a line, they would sort of stay true to that, which I suppose some people like that feeling. I didn't really like that feeling because I like to do little micro adjustments with the ankles and toes and knees to sort of reset and adjust lines because the wave's changing and sometimes what you think's going to happen isn't happening. And I don't like waving my arms to do corrections. It's like a pet peeve, when you're like have to roll up the windows to kind of recorrect a line. So I just didn't really think that the trade-off was there for me. So I kind of stayed away from these edge-tailed quote logs. So Wayne and I worked on this thing where we got the benefits of the turn, but without the liability of that tucked edge and getting any kind of tracking, or worse yet, release when we didn't want it. So yeah, been having some fun with that and thinking, I've been thinking about the 2+1 thing just for fun to get back in there somewhere, but I'm so excited about these logs and eggs I have. I just haven't got to that yet.
I've been kind of like fulfilling a childhood dream and writing Takayamas
Nice.
lately. And because I always looked up to you and Joel, and everyone kind of wanted a Takayama back then
Yeah,
and
those.
still today. And so I've been revisiting a lot of those boards, and Takayama did. His rails and the edge in the back, the tucked edge, are just different than like anything else I could get from anybody else,
Yes.
And I got on a DT4 about a year ago, and it opened up something for me, because I like one of the waves I surf a lot at home in Seal Beach is a it's not like a point wave necessarily. It's kind of like a slow sectiony, like slow and then fast kind of wave. It's
Right.
a right, and I'm a goofy foot. And my whole life trying to ride that wave on a nose rider, if I got behind sections, I felt like the only thing I could do on my backhand was just like crouch down and hold the rail and hope I got around. And all of a sudden, I had a little bit more to work with, had a few more gears. But when I didn't want to do that, it felt pretty traditional otherwise, And it was fast. It's
Yeah.
still like that speed shape, but it nose rides incredible, kind of like all of his boards did.
Yeah, his boards were just very approachable. User-friendly has a bad connotation for some people for some reason, but I spent 20, 25 years or something like that riding them, and the last 2+1, and I still have it, was a beach break model that I rode for years, and it was a Clark foam. Donald had stashed a few Clark foams after they closed down, and he made me this beach break, and I have a funny picture because I took it to Indonesia. I took it to the Mentawais, I want to say in 2009 or 10, and it was a crazy trip. It was for Patagonia. Wayne Lynch was on it, and Jerry Lopez, and all of the Malloy brothers, and this other friend of theirs, Jeff Johnson.
Damn.
It was nuts. And Wayne Lynch was tripping out on the board because he was just like not into longboarding at all. He wasn't into any like looking backward in any way. He was very like, why would you want to do that? Surfing's all about moving forward, progression, making things easier, not harder. And he was really fascinated by the board and the ability to kind of do everything you want. Really sick. I mean, that model, you can nose ride the heck out of it. It's got crazy amount of rockers. So you look at it, you're like, how is this board gonna work? And do, the biggest turns and kind of do all the stuff I would do on a mid-length egg thing. And I have this one shot that came out of the trip that I think I've posted it one time on Instagram, and I put in the caption the kiss the oh I put the forbidden kiss, that was the caption. And it's this wave at Lance's right where I remember this wave so clearly, just squaring off the bottom and going straight up as I've ever gone in my life. And then the board blasted and projected, and I did like this little miniature, probably a credit card air, but it was an air, and came down and landed it perfectly in the transition and came out and went into a cutback. And the image I posted is just like, it's like 95% of the board's out of the water. It was like the coolest thing, man. I don't care what anyone says. It was like one of the most bitching feelings I've had in surfing.
That's awesome. I got to see that photo.
Let's dig it up.
So it was this the famous Devin Howard like blue rail?
No, this one was like a it was like a burnt like a mustard burnt kind of mustardy yellow color, sort
Okay.
of opaquish. And yeah, there was a long period there where I was completely out of any picture, videos, photos. I was married once before. And let's just say it wasn't a wise choice. I didn't pick the best partner. So I went through a weird period, where surfing was really in the back seat for many, many years. Like I was surfing, but I wasn't, I was just kind of like, it was in the mothballs. And then that's why there was sort of like this surge later in life. I got out of that situation, fell in love with this other gal, totally unexpectedly, who we're married and have children. We've been together for like 12 years. And out of all the things that have gone right in my life and like contributed to surfing well at a later age, yeah, my wife, Caitlin's her name, for sure is at the top of that list. Because I think whatever you're doing in life, when you have a partner that believes in you and really helps you realize and see and live like, to your true passions and who you really are in the short life we have. It was incredible, dude. Like, feel so thankful for this last decade. Just a lot of really cool, unexpected things have happened.
Yeah, I can relate. Got a good lady myself. And I talk to a lot of friends and acquaintances and coworkers that just don't have that. And they don't have that support. And I, we're lucky that we found people like that, 'cause not a lot of people, not everybody does.
I know, and you ache for people that are in that situation because you've been there, and or at least I have. And no one wants to be Dr. Phil or tell. No one wants to be told how to live, but you sometimes wish that more people could be that fortunate and that lucky to, yeah, be somewhere that supports that. And because surfing, let's be honest, like it's not the most attractive thing for people in a partnership. It pulls you away. It's like today, this morning, it's like madhouse, like kids doing what they do early in the morning and lots of noise and getting ready to go in here and there and everywhere. And then, had to work, and then the waves looked pretty good today, actually. And I'm like, kind of thinking, okay, it's toward the end of the workday. There's just a f 2 hours left before of the kids even being awake. But that's when they call the witching hour. That's when the kids go nuts,
Oh, yeah.
like really nuts. It's like, man, I really want to be there for Caitlin. She's been there for me all these years, before kids, and just totally supported me. Surfing my brains out whenever I could. And yeah, just realizing how fortunate you can be to have someone who gets it. And so, like I was saying earlier in our discussion, I have a feeling our kids are going to dig being at the beach. And I'm not going to lie. I'm not going to be like, I don't care if the kids surf. I'll be devastated if they don't surf. I would love
Yeah.
them to surf. I hope they do. And we're going to, get them in swim, they're in swim lessons and stuff like that. And if they don't like surfing, they're really going to like making sandcastles because
Yeah.
they're going to be at the beach either way, man.
I know, I say the same thing when people ask, they're like, "Oh, do your kids surf?" And I was like, like at this point they're still young and a little timid still, but every summer, they're out there a lot because that's the kind of family we are. And I'm not going to force them to do anything, but it would behoove them to get into surfing because dad's going to, that's the thing I know about the most. So.
Yeah. Just quickly on that subject, I've sampled a lot of different people on the, do you push surfing on your kids or not? And the polite thing is to say, no, I'd never do that. But I know a couple, I don't want to say their names, but you would know these surfers if I said who their names are, who have just flat out said, look, if you don't force the kids to surf, they're not going to surf. And I have some other friends who have said, you know what? I wished I'd forced my kids to surf. I didn't. I went that I'm not going to force them. And they're just like into emo stuff and like hanging out at the mall. They're like, fuck, you missed that window. So we'll see. We'll have to check back in a few years and see how we're both doing with that.
Yeah, I know. My daughter's 9, and last summer she got the surf bug,
Nice.
and we got her a little foam board that has a little extra rocker so she doesn't purl.
Smart.
And she had me go out there with her once, and then was just going out there on her own, and didn't like wanted me to be around, but didn't want me to help. And I was like,
Wow.
hell yeah,
That's
this
great.
is cool. I was like, I just want one of them. And then I have my son, who, like, we're both boys, so we gravitate towards each other, and
Sure.
I'm trying to get him into skateboarding too. And like, I've tried to skateboard again recently and realized that I
Careful.
may have passed that window. I don't want to get hurt.
Yes.
But he's the younger one and still a little timid, but he'll stand up on his boogie board and do that with his cousins and stuff. So like, it's looking good. I got some hope.
Nice, man. Yeah, cool. Well, sounds like we're both on a really nice point in our lives. And even though I've got some years on you, we're pretty fortunate to be part of this silly little thing called longboard
Yeah, it's pretty great.
surfing.
So you're up in the like Ventura area now, right?
Yes, my wife is from Ventura, and we met in San Diego at Car in Cardiff, where I lived my whole life. And from childhood till mid-20s, I was in the, let's just call it the La Jolla region. And then 25 on, when I got a job at Longboard Magazine, I moved to the Cardiff Encinitas zone to cut the commute in half because that job was up in San Clemente. And then, yeah, about 5 years ago, when we were starting a family, we came here. And that was tough to leave a zone that I was, pretty well entrenched in. But the move, it was a good call. Just got a huge family. And, not to drone on about kids, but let's just put it this way, having a big family around for kids, it's pretty cool, man. It's fun to watch them interact with all the cousins and whatnot.
Yeah, we were talking about that the other day at RingCon. My whole family and my wife's whole family are nearby, and it is invaluable to have all of them around each other and to have the support and to have the babysitting when we need it. It's
Oh, yeah.
I haven't experienced it, but I look at my friends that like moved away and they don't have the family around them. I'm like, how do you do it?
Yeah, exactly. Speaking of babies, I can hear a baby crying in the background. That's our 3-month-old.
Your third, right?
Yes, third and final.
Yeah, we have two, and I was like, we got a boy and a girl, that'll do it for me.
Yeah, that the old quit while you're ahead.
Exactly.
But yeah, things are good up here. I'm working with Channel Island Surfboards, and just still fired up about design. Been lucky to, as I was saying earlier, we pulled Wayne Rich into the program. And yeah, we've got a lot of designs that we're working on that, so we'll have our hands full for years to come. That's pretty exciting.
That's cool. You mentioned it a little earlier, and I'm sure you hear it a lot, but your surfing as of late has been pretty far out. And although I always looked up to you and you were always a good surfer, It's seeing you surf this well at this age, like I said earlier, is inspiring.
Oh, cool.
And like you really are ripping, and it seems like you got a good program going on with Channel Islands.
Yeah, thank you. It sounds like a sales pitch. I promise it's not, but getting to know the equipment a lot better has helped a lot. And I think I kind of mailed it in for years. And I, you know, the thing with Donald, who was amazing, the only thing that was tough with him, and you may have heard this before, is you got what you got. And so you sort of, he was like, he'll take care of the details. So there was never this like this room to like really dive in and work on stuff and get to like express what you're feeling and then work with a shaper to really dial it in. Because he was such like, he was the freaking man. He's like, what are you going to tell this guy? And unfortunately, you know, it was horrible. He passed away. I think I was on the team for like 25 years or something like that. Like one of the longest standing team riders, perhaps. Anyway, I was just totally blown away when he passed away. It's like, what am I gonna do now? And it ended up kind of opening all these doors that were unexpected. And then I tried stuff and went on this journey of working with a few different people, like Tyler Hatzikian, Thomas Beckson, you know, and got boards from a few other people in between all that, and unexpectedly landed with Channel Islands when we, you know, because we moved to Ventura. And that journey of understanding the equipment, I just want to say I think it's a big part of that, being able to surf at a high level as I'm hitting 50. So there's a lot of factors that go into it. It's having your mind right and then really getting to know. I think the one thing I learned is just not what I think I said it in the beginning of our talk. Don't waste time on things that aren't working for you. You know, like I can see it in people when they're surfing. I see a lot of people, a lot of traditional surfers, longboarders riding boards that are way too flat. The rockers are terrible. And I don't want to say any names, but if they would just add a little bit of rocker to their board, which sounds funny saying that about a traditional single fin, but the boards are too flat and they're outrunning the pocket and they don't settle into the wave very nicely. They're sort of fighting the curve of the board is they're fighting it.
I don't know. Well, I do know why rocker got like a bad connotation in longboarding, but rocker is your friend. You just don't want, if you're looking for something more traditional, you obviously don't want the like Joey Hawkins nose.
No.
But a little bit of rocker, wherever it's at, is a good thing.
Yeah, and you get it in the right places. And I think where people are maybe missing the mark is that front third of the board, sort of from 12 inches behind the nose to like the middle of the board. A lot of those rockers look really flat. And for whatever that's worth to whoever shapes or whoever happens to be listening to this.
Yeah,
Flat of a board.
I know. And I mean, there's a place for a flat board, but
Sure.
not necessarily if you want to like get good nose rides. And
No.
even, like connect good turns. So
The same thing is true on the mid-length boards. Like, there's a lot of them out there that are like ironing boards, and you don't see people doing really beautiful turns on them for a reason. They're just too flat. And yeah, so I'm not going to give away all the trade secrets, but I think that's something worth looking at. Like when you pick up a board, kind of pay attention. Like this thing's really flat. It's going to trim well and it's going to hit those high lines and it's going to be speedy, but you're going to sort of rest a little bit when you go to do the turns. And when you go to nose ride, like we were just saying, you just sort of like outrun the pocket.
Right. I got an 8 foot flow egg
Oh.
recently from Takayama, and I've never really had an egg like that per se. Like, it's definitely watching what you were doing with the Channel Island stuff. Like, I've always liked eggs, being a longboarder and looking up to you guys. But I had them do it as a 2+1 though, and
Nice.
there's just something that, like, down the line speed is what really sets it apart. Like,
Sure.
standing in the middle of the board and like those big bottom turns and like making sections you wouldn't normally make is great, but you can still crank it around back into the white wash. It's pretty great.
Nice. Well, there's no shortage of ways to keep things interesting. And, just like there's always going to be another swell. There's always going to be another design that you're not anticipating that's going to just blow your mind.
Speaking of the CI log, I linked up with Matt, the wax head, and he had one of your like a demo board I think you let him use, and he used it at that same wave I was telling you about, the right, and it was cool to see that board and get my hands on it. I didn't get to ride it, but he was riding it really good.
Yeah, he enjoyed it. He said it was a little too light for him. He wanted something a little bit heavier, but I thought that was a fair, critique. We glassed him with double six deck and six bottom because I felt that with that unique feature in the tail to kind of give you another gear, so to speak. And having the little bit more sensitivity from the weight, it's not like it's super light or anything. There's still some really nice weight to it, but Matt's like really traditional. So yeah, it was fun to kind of hear from someone at his level. Like he really liked it. He's like, man, it really is fast. And like it's a different kind of turn. When you go to turn it, you're getting a projection and like a rebound speed. There's this guy Keoki. I don't know if you know who Keoki is. Aguibo. He's a North Shore guy, a great photographer, good friend of mine.
Longboarder from back in the day.
Yeah, totally great longboarder. And I had an extra one. I was on the North Shore last summer. I actually went to the South Shore, but the North Shore was breaking like in May. It was really good, and we were out at Chun's and. Yeah, I just wanted his feedback. I just wanted some friends to try it, and it was really cool to watch him. And he was that's what he was tripping out on was the deep bottom turn and the cutback. He's like, I haven't rebounded off of whitewater, not like a Kai Stallus high performance wrap. I'm not saying it was like that, but for a log, like when you whipped it back toward the whitewater, and you kind of go to that lower part of the wave and just crank it around. A lot of traditional logs just sort of slow down and bog at that time, at that moment in time of a turn, which I think anybody who's ridden a traditional longboard just embraces the failure of the board as part of the experience. That's like that's what they do, right? So what Wayne Rich offered to the equation was to just bypass that. Like you can still have your cake and eat it too. And I'm not going to make a claim that this is the best thing ever, but it's the best one I've personally ridden out of all the things I've tried. It just kind of does everything that I've wanted, without putting an edge on it. So maybe an edge is a better solution for some folks out there, but I'm sticking my guns. We're not going to do the edge thing.
How's it been on your back end with that board?
It's really good. I don't go left that often, but
I know, I was gonna say, I haven't seen you going left on that thing yet.
at the beach breaks. It no, it base it's sick. It does really. I love the rebound cutbacks on it are really nice. holds up nice, high and tight, holds up, doesn't slip out. Yeah, I need to work on a like an edit or something just to prove that I can go left. My friends will stop giving me a hard time.
Yeah, I've been surfing that right at home. It's like, I mean, obviously surfing on your backhand's fun, but
Yeah.
like most of what I'm surfing are beach breaks, and that's the only wave around really that's kind of not like a normal beach break.
Right.
And so, like I said, I just liked having going back to the 2+1s and riding that same kind of shape as a single fin too. But like, 'cause like I've always loved traditional boards and like nose riders, but primarily when I'm going left, you know, unless it's like a perfectly lined up wave.
Sure.
And so it was
Yeah.
nice, you know, I like that even if it's not a speed shape, or if it's like what CJ's doing, like having a little bit of edge in the back, just giving us a little more options when it comes to doing a wrap on something that is more or less traditional, you know?
Right. Yep. Yeah.
Well, we could probably talk about all this stuff for the rest of the evening, but
If anyone's still listening.
exactly. Well, Devin, thank you for your time.
Yeah, you bet. TJ, it's nice to connect with you. I remember meeting you when you were quite young at San Onofre, and I remember a lot of people saying you're like the next up and coming guy. I want to say like it might have even been Cody or somebody told me that. And yeah, so it was
Cody
cool to
Simpkins. Well, that's cool.
So it's cool to see your name pop back up and see this Instagram account. It's like who's doing this stuff? Like, you know, and so for probably a small number of us out there, it's fun to see it, and hopefully you keep doing it. Don't get burnt out on it. And I'm sure you've got enough magazines, but if you run out of any issues, let me know. I've got, because I worked at Longboard for 5 years. Yeah, I've got most of the issues, I believe.
Yeah.
Not all.
I wanted to tell one more story.
Sure.
I know that we talked about this recently, but in private, but I went to Longboard Magazine when I was still in high school with Josh Moore and Travis Kurian in San Clemente. And you know, this was like all brand new to me. I was a pretty shy kid. I'm still kind of a non-outgoing kind of guy in social settings. And I was just wide-eyed, and I remember I met you, and you were working on the magazine, and they were like, "Yeah, we'll try to get you. We'll talk to Devin about getting you in the dropping in." And I was like, "Oh, cool!" And so I talked to you, and I think you interviewed me for it, and then I think you left like right after
I screwed you.
Yeah, I mean, I don't even know if that's actually like true as far as the timeline goes, but I remember thinking like, ah, shit. But like that was one of those things, you know, for kids my age for sure. Like it was like, oh, I gotta get in that dropping in. And I was like, I think I'm in. And nope.
Nuts, man. Oh, who's that? Do you know that shaper Travis Reynolds? Do you know who he is?
That sounds familiar.
He's a Santa Cruz guy.
Yeah.
Like he's one of the many kids that I, you know, had done the interview to do that dropping in thing. So it's I'm so sorry that didn't happen for you, but if that's the way it played out, if it makes you feel any better, I did leave for a good reason.
Yeah.
I was so I'd been at Longboard for 5 years, and Thomas Campbell was making a new film. I'd been invited to be in The Seedling, which did really well, and then he was doing this other film that became known as Sprout, and he had already been filming for a while for it. I think this was in like the spring of 2003, and I was getting frustrated with the creative decisions at the magazine. I didn't like the way the art, I didn't love the art direction. And then I was doing the work of the editor, but I wasn't allowed to have the title. This sounds really petty, but I think people can relate when they've been at a job and you're doing the work of something, but you're not getting the title or the pay. And it's such like a little lame thing, but it's actually meaningful to people. So anyone who's a boss out there listening to this, just remember this.
Yeah, it happens to everyone.
That sometimes the titles are just more about recognition and respect. It's not really about the money. A lot of people will do things for less money if they feel that they're being valued and respected. So it got to a point where I wasn't feeling that. And then I got this invitation from Thomas to essentially just like quit my job and become a freelance photographer. Because I'd gotten into photography through Jim Roosie and I was shooting more. I learned a lot from Todd Saunders, who was our photo editor. And God, that was the ultimate leap of faith. I had just bought a condo, which was a big deal. And the fear factor is real when you're like, you get trapped into that like security. I mean, I wasn't making shit. I was making like 45 grand a year. You know, it's just like next level poverty nowadays, right? So,
Totally. It was a little better then, but yeah, not now.
And so that was like the ultimate leap, but it ended up being the best thing ever. And I learned a lot from it. So, unfortunately, you were part of the sacrifice of that,
No,
but hopefully you understand.
I totally understand. It's more of a funny,
Is funny.
and like I said, I don't even know if that's true, but that's the story I like to tell. But
It
yeah, I
probably
mean,
is. It probably is true. And I thought you were going to tell me like, yeah, and you were kind of a dick and kind of glib
no.
stuff, because there's stories that like Alex Nost tells. He'd have to tell you the story, but it goes something like this. Like guys like Alex would stop by, maybe with Cody Simpkins or other people, and they would just be high as a kite. And I'd look at them and I'd be like, "Are you guys high?" And I would just be messing with them, and they got super paranoid and like, "Dude, that Devin guy's a dick. Like he knows we're high and like he doesn't like us."
That's hilarious.
I was just fucking with them. It was like they were too high to realize that I was just messing with them.
Yeah,
So I think.
I think the first time I was in the same vicinity as you was at the Rabbit Kick High, like the first year I went.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
And but like I didn't know you obviously. And I think during that time you had like shorter hair and a goatee.
Yeah, that was
You don't look like you do now, and like you have most of the
baseball look.
time. But I remember knowing that you worked for Longboard and seeing you like in the like where we all ate, like interviewing people with like a microphone.
I was
And I
working.
remember thinking like, oh man, I'm gonna be one of those people one day. But we all of us young kids thought professional longboarding was a viable option.
Yeah.
Yeah,
Well,
we were just naive at the time.
I mean, the whole thing of working at the magazine, that was like, to my mind, that was like my Mickey Dora scam. You know, it was, I wasn't good enough to be a paid surfer, a sponsored surfer. I was good enough to sort of be in the mix, getting a few finals and be in a few videos. But I always knew I wasn't like the outstanding guy. I was, and I was okay with that. But when I realized that, I did an internship at that magazine in college, and then I was offered a job, I went, wait a second, I can kind of be like doing the pro surf thing, be around this world that I love, maybe contribute something positive, help these old guys running the magazine know what's up with what the younger guys are doing, right? And so it was a good gig for a while. Got some nice surf trips out of it, like that Rabbit Kai event and many others. And yeah, ended up learning a whole hell of a lot from it, and it really set me up for a pretty nice life.
Yeah, in Longboard Magazine, kind of in the same way we were talking about Herbie's movies, like Longboard Magazine kind of had the not the same vibe, but a similar overall vibe, and that it was like my dad introduced me to it, and it seemed like it was more for my dad than it was for someone my age, you know?
Absolutely.
And it had that like dorky dad vibe. And there was times that I was like, ah, this is dorky. And then in hindsight, I'm like, that's why it was so special. It had its own unique vibe going on that was kind of goofy and kind of silly. And then there was really rad parts of it too. And I mean, I devoured that magazine. And I remember like looking back on all of the old magazines now and posting the photos. Like I remember like every little detail of some of those photos and some of those articles.
Yeah, well, it's cool, man. Keep sharing that stuff, and it'll be for, I don't know, however many people are following what you're doing, it'll be special for them, and maybe some young folks will discover some things. 'Cause like I overheard somebody the other day saying like, "Oh, have you ever heard of Jimmy Gamboa?" And this young longboard kid's like, "Who?" Like, just no idea, So
Yeah, that's wild.
yeah, it's wild, and it's like it's not totally unexpected either. It's like
No.
the print world's long gone. So if you aren't digging this stuff up and sharing it, those people go by the wayside. And I think it's nice to know of and remember those people the same way that I reference certain people from the 60s. It's no different.
Yeah, and it's interesting you bring up Jimmy because I never knew him, I never met him, but that day I saw you at RenCon, we ended up going to C Street. And as we were getting out, he was walking down the stairs and was paddling out, and I was like starstruck. And I was like trying to rack my brain. I was like, did I ever meet this guy? Like, what can I bring up right now? But I just said, what's up? And he went on his way and we went on ours. But it was pretty cool. I think Joel may have said that he wasn't really surfing anymore, but I was stoked to see him surfing.
Yeah, I think he's surfing. I saw him recently at the same spot and said what's up, and yeah, he still gets out, I think just like I was saying earlier, just the surf thing in our lives comes in waves, and there's periods of your life where you're doing a lot of it. It just depends what, what else is going on. And but just know it's always there for you. And once you're a surfer, you're always a surfer, as far as I'm concerned.
Totally. Like a lot of the old guys that quit, but were still in the scene, like Greg Knoll and those guys, like they hadn't
Sure,
surfed
man.
for a long time, but by the time I met him, he had all the best stories still and everything.
Yeah. You don't ever stop thinking like a surfer. Once you're in that club, it doesn't go away very easily.
Yeah, it's pretty awesome. We're pretty lucky.
Yeah, man. Well, it's nice chat. I guess it's getting pretty late. We should go to bed and let whoever's still listening to us include their evening as well.
That sounds great. Thank you so much, Devin. And we should try to do this again because there's so much we could still talk about.
Sure. Whenever you're ready for round two, I'll bore you and your listeners to tears. I'm happy to do it. All
Right, buddy. Have a good night.
right, take care, TJ.
See
Thank
ya.
you.
Thank you for listening to the LINAC podcast. If you would like to be a guest or sponsor of the show, please reach out to me via direct message on Instagram at longboardingisnotacrime or via email at noseriderdie@gmail.com. Please tell your friends and spread the word.
Later, dudes.
Later,
rip, hang pen.